there was a suggestion of naturalistic movement that cartoons had never had, and that character became Coco the Clown, one of their very famous cartoons that preceded Betty Boop. But in the cartoon you're talking about, Minnie the Moocher, you can see Cab Calloway, the American band leader, who's providing the music for the cartoon, dancing. He has got a very signature dancing style, very almost weightless. It looks like he's dancing nearly without gravity. And he's dancing in the beginning of the cartoon, and then midway through you see ghostly walrus dancing with the exact same moves, and so you understand that the walrus has been rotoscoped from Cab Calloway. The other content you're talking about, you know, with ghosts and electric chairs and this sort of fever dream, which is clearly seemingly drug-induced, is there as well. And the song is St. James Infirmary, which has a lot of variations throughout.
Artist Lucy Raven. The strangely disturbing 1932 Betty Boop cartoon, Minnie the Moocher, is just one of the films she's curated as part of her exhibition at the Serpentine Gallery here in London. More from her coming up today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead,
Meet Me in St. Louis is one of my favorite holiday films.
It's so nice to see you. I feel like we haven't had a moment of silence since the election.
We'll look at why we might need the quintessential Christmas movie this year more than ever. Plus, our Christmas gift guide for film lovers. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. What's your favourite Christmas movie? Are you the sentimental type who cozies up with Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life year after year? Or is Gremlins more your style? Hello from London, I'm Ben Ryland. There are a few festive films that I often find myself rewatching this time of year. But there's one that always makes the cut year after year, and it might just be the most Christmassy of them all. Allow us to present you now with a tale of two friends who, despite a year of political pollution, find they're simply not immune to the nostalgic charm of a classic.
I'm so happy we're doing this. Meet Me in St. Louis is one of my favorite holiday films.
It's so nice to see you. I feel like we haven't had a moment of silence since the election.
I still can't believe it.
Tell me about it. It's all anyone talks about anymore. Trump, Trump, Trump. Oh, and Brexit.
Please, please, no T-word and no B-word for the rest of the film. Let's not TARDIS Judy's screen time.
Deal. We won't mention it for the rest of the film. At least we both did our part by voting for Hillary.
Huh. Maybe you voted for Hillary.
Wait, you didn't vote for Hillary?
Well, if you must know. Oh, I did not vote for Crooked Hillary.
How could you not?
Oh, and what? Funnel more money into ISIS? Let her get away with Benghazi? And don't even get me started on those emails.
The only terrible thing she did was email about some creme brulee.
Oh, please. That was such a cover. Look, we are talking about the President of the United States here, okay? The leader of the free world. I mean, we cannot afford to have somebody who's... You know what? No, we're not going to do this. It's Christmas. This is the pinnacle of classic Christmas motion picture entertainment. We're going to make the Yuletide gay, yada, yada, yada. Let's not do this and waste time arguing. Pass the popcorn.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Remember when we watched this for the first time?
Of course. It was the first Christmas we were living together, and you were insistent on putting up that old tree your parents gave us, the ones with the built-in fairy lights.
I loved that tree.
Except for the rotted wiring that got you electrocuted.
Yeah, but at least it warmed the mulled wine for us.
And then we spent the whole night drinking and singing along with Judy and company.
You sang along. I didn't know the words yet.
Well... if there's anything we can learn from a big musical, it's that there's nothing a little song can't fix.
I hear that. I just loved how old-fashioned and storybook perfect everything is. The lights are so bright, and suddenly you're one of the family, and things are so simple and nice. They decorate the house to look like a Christmas card, and make homemade ketchup, and everybody gets along all the time. It's utopian.
Kind of like what the Brexiteers expect Britain to become. A pure-blood, wee little place where we'll all break bread and throw back pints with King Arthur himself.
Mm. But at least the referendum gave the people a chance to be heard.
And which people is that? The out-of-touch-with-reality old people who voted leave and who will be dead by the time anything actually happens?
Look, I'm not saying I agree with them. But if the Supreme Court overruled it, democracy as we know it would be dead.
Oh, and when did you start working for Breitbart?
Oh, shut up.
Your appointment call from Trump should be coming any day now.
Shh! It's starting.
Yourself a merry little Christmas.
There's never been anything like it in the whole world.
We don't have to come here on a train or stay in a hotel. It's right in our own hometown.
Grandpa, they'll never tear it down, will they?
Well, they better not.
Oh, you know, I swear, it gets better every time we watch it.
An untouchable classic.
What were we even arguing about?
Who cares? Like you said, the singing made it all better. Rose, let's never disagree again.
Never, never again, dear sister. I love how it's 72 years old, but it still completely works today.
It's ageless.
Could you imagine if they actually tried to remake it, though?
Like they do with everything?
Yeah, but it would have to be so different. Like instead of the clang, clang, clang of the trolley, it'd be like the ring, ring, of a Snapchat, you know? Or Tootie would have some dark Instagram account with, like, pictures of mutilated dolls.
Yes! And instead of the World's Fair, it would be Harry Potter Land at Universal Studios.
Oh, and it wouldn't even be the Christmas ball. It would have to be, like, the holiday party. And all the girls would wear off-the-shoulder tops and order espresso martinis.
And the guys would do Jaeger bombs.
Jaeger bombs.
But who would play Esther? Oh, I know. Amy Adams. She's got those sad eyes.
No, Amy Adams can't sing.
Neither could Renee Zellweger, but she's still got the Oscar nomination for Chicago.
It would be Natalie Portman.
Nah, too serious.
Ariana Grande.
Too whiny.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Too everywhere.
How about...
Nah, they'll never remake this. It's too perfect the way it is. And let's face it, nowadays, nobody living in St. Louis would pass up the chance to move to New York.
That was Meet Me at the Movies, written and performed by Brian Lewandowski and also featuring Molly Merwin. They're part of the improv group Careless Vespa. Now, when it comes to Christmas movies, I really don't think anything can surpass 1944's Meet Me in St. Louis. But picking the peak of seasonal cinema at this time of year can be a touchy topic, especially when the cinema show's Christmas correspondent Tara Judah is involved. Tara, we've got Judy Garland in one of the greatest MGM musicals at the peak of Hollywood's golden age. What's not to love?
Look, there's a lot of musicals that make it to the Christmas list. So, you know, we've got Holiday Inn, White Christmas with Bing Crosby. There's Eight Women, a French film, actually, Huit Femmes, which is set at Christmas time. I love that because it's all about the death of the patriarchy. And it's got the most magnificent cast of French women in it that you'll ever see together on screen. Isabelle Huppert, Fanny Ardant, Catherine Deneuve, they are all in there. But Meet Me in St. Louis, I don't know. I like it. I don't revisit it every year.
For me, when I watch this film, I see this extraordinarily melancholy feeling of optimism. And maybe that's not what was intended. I expect perhaps it wasn't, considering it came out of the MGM Dream Factory back when they were spending
gazillions on all of their productions. From what I recall, this film came about at a bit of a transitional time for MGM as well. This was about the time that they realized that if they pooled all of their resources into these big mega productions that were extraordinarily expensive, they could actually create one film that everyone went to see rather than six or seven that a few people went to see. So this film actually cost a lot of money, and it was built around Judy Garland. Now, when I watch this film, though, I get this feeling as though, I mean, this was America back when they were getting towards the end of their involvement in the Second World War. They obviously wouldn't have known that at the time, but there was a lot of feeling of change on the horizon for people in everyday America back then. This film seems to communicate that sort of feeling so perfectly, but in a way that you can imagine there would have been a lot of people back then who just needed some time to escape. They just wanted to get away from whatever was happening in their everyday lives, walk into the Picture Palace and see this screen lit up with the most beautiful colours, with all these amazing fun songs. Everyone is so happy. The emotions that were involved in here are nothing too dark, too bleak. And yet at the same time, we've got so many musical numbers and so many moments in the film that suggest change is on the horizon, change is inevitable, we can stick together, we can weather it as a family, but in the end, we will need to face up to this.
Yeah, look, I think that everything you say is absolutely right. I don't disagree with any of that. I think for me, perhaps part of it is that this type of film, and I put with that other holiday movies that people watch around this time of year that probably aren't specifically Christmas films, so things like The Wizard of Oz as well, these very beautiful Technicolor films that would play in old theatres, is that I probably would watch it if there was an old, you know, opaque theatre with gorgeous, stunning, opulent ceilings and curtains. If that was playing in 35mm in Technicolor, I'd probably go see it. But to watch it at home on DVD, I don't know. I don't feel like the grandeur is there. Maybe that's why I don't revisit them anymore. I mean, I certainly used to have this on my list when I was a child or a teenager, and when I had access to one of those cinemas on a more regular basis when I lived in Melbourne and I could go to the Astor. But we don't really get the opportunity to see that on the big screen quite so much. I mean, that said, actually, it is coming to cinemas digitally this Christmas. So there is the option for some people, depending on where you live, maybe to see it in cinemas again. But I think that those films, because of the grandeur and perhaps because of the Technicolor as well, I mean, I do always feel like Technicolor deserves the big screen that it was created for. I don't know, it's just not a home viewing one for me.
I can tell you that of all the films that can transcend the limitations of having a relatively smaller screen, most televisions are significantly smaller than a cinema screen. However, with those limitations in mind, if any film can actually surpass that, this has got to be one of them. And I think that has got to do with the genius of what we're watching on the screen. It's not possible that RKO, Warner Brothers, Columbia, any of the others, they couldn't have come up with something like this because they weren't in line with what Louis B. Mayer was all about expressing. Okay, it wouldn't work today because that's not how the family setup is anymore. That's not how society is anymore. But he understood that in order to make people want to come back to the cinema, you can't just be reflecting what's happening in the real world. There are other studios that were doing that at the time and the other directors, as we've covered on this show. But he was about taking people out of that and giving them some sort of artificial version of how life could be in some sort of faraway fantasy. And I think he did that so well.
I took hold of his sleeve with my hand, and as if it were planned, he stayed on with me, and it was grand just to stand with his hand holding mine to the end of the line.
Tara Judah is the honorary Christmas correspondent for The Cinema Show this year. She'll be back for our Christmas special next week to walk us through some more festive favourites. Now, you might be one of those amazingly organised people who's entirely on top of all of their Christmas shopping. Well, gold stars for you, but if you're anything like me, there are likely at least a couple of leftovers on your list that have so far eluded your gift buying. Well, join us now for a browse inside The Cinema Show's gift shop. Thank you. Taking pride of place in our Christmas window display this year is a book that's, at least ostensibly, not actually about movies. But it'll happily find a spot on the bookshelf of any fan of the Caped Crusader. In the 1960s, Batman was, of course, a star of the small screen, and this new book, Batman, a celebration of the classic TV series by Bob Garcia, captures all the campy fun of the program.
Batman? Yes, Mr. Wayne. Have you heard Mr. Freeze's scurrilous demands? Just briefly. If Robin and I act as go-betweens, are you prepared to make the telecast at midnight and pay the ransom, Mr. Wayne?
Bat fans were delighted this year when the man himself, Adam West, his Robin, Burt Ward, and the original Catwoman, Julie Newmar, reunited to voice their characters in a new animated Batman movie styled after the television show. It's out now on DVD and would make the perfect accompaniment to this book.
You're very beautiful, Catwoman.
Yes, you're quite right. I am.
Now, movies are often experienced alone in the darkened setting of a cinema. But true devotees of the medium will know that cinematic art runs much deeper. And this book, of posters in fact, would make an exceptional gift for exactly that kind of person. More than just another coffee table book, this is a celebration of the art of Saul Bass, a stunning collection of some of his best known artworks and many of his lesser known projects too. Published by Lawrence King, the posters are printed on premium thick card and can be easily removed for mounting in a 12 by 16 frame. And staying on that theme of enjoying movies outside of the screen, many listeners of The Cinema Show will likely be very familiar with their favourite set of headphones. But when it comes to enjoying the full weight of cinematic soundtracks, a pair of earbuds simply won't do. That's where this record player comes in. The Project Classic Turntable comes in a simple rosenut finish with a timeless modern design. The renewed interest in vinyl has seen some manufacturers travel a little too far down the retro path. This one places the audio format in today's setting, and it's the perfect way to sit back and enjoy your favourite Bernard Herrmann, John Williams or Miklos Rocha score. And to make it all sound crisp and perfect, well, no expense should be spared. Why not splash out on the Bang & Olufsen Biolab 18 speaker? The tall, slender design in walnut, maple, or oak strikes the perfect balance between audio necessity and designer elegance. And if you throw in a subscription to Mubi, you may well find yourself with rather few reasons to leave the house this winter. Still to come on The Cinema Show, Lucy Raven walks us through her exhibition at the Serpentine Gallery here in London, which includes a screening of a very bizarre 1932 Betty Boop cartoon short. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called Mubi.
Sometimes Wells' films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, Mubi adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. And now for a word from our friend, the unmistakable Betty Boop.
They always pick on me. They never, never let me be.
Everyone knows Betty Boop, even if we might not recall how we came to know about her. A star of cinema screens throughout the 1930s, her sexpot characterization suffered from creeping censorship, eventually forcing her off the screen altogether. The artist Lucy Raven recently launched her first solo exhibition at the Serpentine Gallery here in London, titled Edge of Tomorrow. The moving image inspires just about everything she creates, and she's even put together a special curation of films, some screening at theatres and some inside a purpose-built theatre at the gallery. One of the films Lucy chose is the 8-minute Betty Boop short, Minnie the Moocher, which at first may seem like a very bizarre choice, but, well, we'll let her explain.
It's very dark, yes. It's one of my favorite cartoons, and it's included in the program because it also foregrounds this process of rotoscoping that Max Fleischer actually invented in 1915 and is essentially still the basis for all visual effects work in today's films, including films like Edge of Tomorrow. And what it entails is outlining every figure in a frame and isolating it. Today we do that with digital effects in order to digitally manipulate certain parts of a frame. But what Fleischer was doing was he was nudged by an editor where he was working at a science magazine in the States to try to come up with a way to make cartoons move more smoothly. Up until that point, there were cartoons, but they were very jerky. And so he had this idea of filming his brother Dave dancing in a clown suit. And he filmed him with a 16-millimeter camera, then rear-projected the film frame by frame onto a sheet of frosted glass with a sheet of paper on top of it and loosely outlined each frame. And when he put them together, there was a suggestion of naturalistic movement that cartoons had never had. And that character became Coco the Clown, one of their very famous cartoons that preceded Betty Boop. But in the cartoon you're talking about, Minnie the Moocher, you can see Cab Calloway, the American band leader, who's providing the music for the cartoon, dancing. He has got a very signature dancing style, very almost weightless. It looks like he's dancing nearly without gravity. And he's dancing in the beginning of the cartoon, and then midway through you see ghostly walrus dancing with the exact same moves. And so you understand that the walrus has been rotoscoped from Cab Calloway. The other content you're talking about, you know, with ghosts and electric chairs and this sort of fever dream, which is clearly seemingly drug-induced, is there as well. And the song is St. James Infirmary, which has a lot of variations throughout American songwriting history. And it's sort of tragic and dark, but also very suggestive song, depending on who's singing it.
So you've got Minnie the Moocher, as we said, Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Groundhog Day, as you mentioned, and All That Jazz. Just in a few words, explain to me, what are you evoking with your curation of films?
One of the things that links all of these films is a set of questions about how the body is animated and motion capture and movement. So that's something I've been thinking about and exploring in different works in the show throughout. But all of these films to me are touchstones for that in different ways. And I think that often sci-fi and horror and cartoons are where you see some of these ideas most explicitly. They're also all films I just really totally love. I mean, maybe to speak briefly about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that's a sort of case that you have people's bodies actually just being taken over by replicas of themselves. And you know, we talk a lot about motion capture today in digital films and how that works. And to take it back to rotoscopy and Max Fleischer, I've been interested in this idea of taking somebody's movement and actually sort of extracting it from their body, like extracting Cab Calloway's very signature dance move and applying it to a walrus. But that happens in different ways throughout all of these films. In a way, it's a very sci-fi or sort of horrific idea to be able to take not just, say, the voice of one person and put it onto another, but the movement and the body. And it's also could be spectacular, funny, or all the different characteristics that these films have. But maybe there's a fine line to me between the humor and the horror that I'm sort of trying to bring together through the program.
Lucy Raven's exhibition is called Edge of Tomorrow, and it's on at the Serpentine Gallery here in London until the 12th of February. For details and a list of films screening alongside it, head over to serpentinegalleries.org. And that's it for today. Next week, it's our Christmas Eve edition, filled with so much festive frivolity, we might even put Santa out of his job. And if walking in a winter wonderland isn't your thing, well, we'll tell you about a cinema on the sunnier side of the globe where movies are best consumed outdoors.
Today's program was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your audio. And we'll leave you now with Cab Calloway recreating his signature tune in a scene from the 1980 film The Blues Brothers. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.
She was the roughest, toughest, frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale.